Pursuant to House File Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the House Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee to order. The CLA will take the roll and determine which members are present. And after that, we are going to take a brief moment of reflection on what's happened today. Committee Administrator Mouse, could you please, CLA, will you please take the roll, Ms. Mouse?
Chair Bernardi.
Present.
Bernardi, present. Vice Chair Christensen.
Present.
Christensen, present. Representative O'Neill. Representative Albright.
Present.
Albright, present. Representative Daniels. Representative Daniels.
I think there might be a technical issue there, but I do see Representative Daniels swing on. We're just not quite hearing him when he speaks.
Okay. Daniels, present. Representative Erickson.
Present.
Erickson.
Present.
Erickson, present. Representative Hansen.
Present.
Hansen, present. Representative Heintzman.
Present.
Heintzman, present. Representative Howard.
Present.
Howard, present. Representative Keeler.
Present.
Keeler, present. Representative Cleveland.
Can do my higher ed.
Okay.
One second.
Representative Cleveland. Cleveland, present.
Cleveland, present. Yes, thank you.
Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick, present.
Kosnick, present. Representative Krishaw. Representative Krishaw. Representative Mason.
Mason, present.
Mason, present. Representative Meckland.
Meckland, present.
Meckland, present. Representative Noor.
Noor, present.
Noor, present. Representative Sandell.
Present.
Sandell, present. Representative Sandsted.
Sandsted, present.
Sandsted, present. Representative Thompson.
Thompson, present.
Thompson, present. And a quorum is present.
I do see Representative Krisha is also on here. I think we might have missed.
Representative Krisha is present.
Okay. And we have a quorum.
Thank you very much. Before we approve the minutes, I'd like to take a moment today to acknowledge what's happened, tragedy that's happened today, and want to extend our deepest sympathies to Representative O'Neill and her community. And I would like to yield my time, so to speak, to Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, one of our members and their community has suffered a very traumatic and very devastating act of vengeance this afternoon, starting this morning. And this is not something that we would wish upon any community in our state, nor in this nation. And so just out of an abundance of care and concern for Representative O'Neill, I'm asking that we just pause for a moment of reflection and silence as we contemplate the lives affected and the community as they rally to one another and start to heal up and bind the wounds that have been exacted upon them.
Thank you, Representative Albright. We'd like to take a moment of silence.
Thank you.
Thank you, members. I would like to move on. And would someone like to make a motion to approve the minutes of February 3rd, 2021?
I'll make that motion, Madam Chair.
Okay, I heard two on that one. I see someone's, okay. So Representative Albright approves the minutes for February 3rd, 2021. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for February 3rd, 2021 are approved. Today on our agenda, we will be hearing a presentation from Dr. Bruce Corey. He is with Concordia College in St. Paul. Dr. Corey is and our presentation will be on racial economic disparities in higher education and the workforce. After that, we will hear a short presentation from the Minnesota Higher Education Partnership on their 2020 legislative recommendations for achieving racial equity in higher education, followed by testimony on the same subject from the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. We also have 20 minutes of time set aside for member questions after Dr. Corey's presentation, and we'll take time again at the end of the hearing for our final two presenters. So Dr. Corey will start us off, and then we also have the presentation from the Minnesota Higher Education, Equity in Education Partnership and their higher education recommendations. And then, like I said, testimony from the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. First on the agenda today, we have a presentation from Dr. Corey. Dr. Corey is a Twin City-based economist and longtime member of the Concordia University St. Paul faculty, with a specific focus on Black, Indigenous, people of color community, businesses, and the growing impact that communities of color and Indigenous people have on our broader economy. Dr. Corey brings unique perspective and insight relating to Minnesota's business landscape and to higher education. Dr. Corey, thank you for joining our committee today. Please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, Vice Chair Christensen, Representative O'Neill, Representative Albright, and members of the committee. I also stand with you in sorrow and solidarity with the people of Buffalo during this very difficult time. Thank you for this opportunity to share some insights on racial disparities in Minnesota and some recommendations as they relate to higher education. I want to commend the Minnesota House Select Committee on Racial Equity, on racial justice, for their deliberations and the report that they brought before the state of Minnesota. They have helped us identify and articulate the patterns of racism and systemic racism that exists in the city, in the state. And in doing so, they help us come to a spot where we can look at the future and look towards solutions. So I am honored to be here to present some thoughts and ideas. And I thank Chairs Richardson and Moran for their work with the House Committee's report. Chair Bernardi mentioned my background. I have also a deep experience in higher ed and relationships that with not only the private college, University of Concordia and the system, but also with Minnesota State for many years. I've been involved with community colleges and exploring relationships with community colleges. And President Ron Thomas of Dakota County Technical College and I worked around rural entrepreneurship and how we could build that into the curriculum. And in the University of Minnesota, I was a Mondale Fellow with Vice President Mondale in the 90s when President Clinton came to office. And it was fascinating as a new vice president was coming into the country, listening from our vice president about what's going on in the White House. And I spent some time with Dr. Myers of the Humphrey Institute, and we explored globally on the ground remedies to racial and ethnic inequalities in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and Brazil, and brought those understanding to our communities. So I will share now some of the concepts that basically the Minnesota solution to racial and economic disparities. What I would present today is basically briefly, what is the Minnesota paradox and what are the estimates of economic cost of racism that I've estimated, and then some solutions in the area of higher education. So Minnesota has been very well recognized for the high quality of life and a thriving economy, but also has the challenge of one of the worst racial disparities, especially for Black Minnesotans and Native and Indigenous people of Minnesota. And so some of these roots of systemic racism can be found in these maps, historic redlining maps that determined and defined wealth creating opportunities for some and not for others. And so in my research, in my PhD, I looked at how these different processes from the mother's womb to the resources available to the household ultimately have their impacts on child survival and development outcomes. So what we see sometimes are caused by some deeper impacts from childbirth and the surrounding environments. And in the area of education, there are these patterns that begin from a poor preparation in school, to needing remedial college education, to the choice of academic majors that determine ultimately the professions and the earning abilities that people, our BIPOC students, ultimately end up with. So when we look at data from the ACT about college readiness benchmarks for Minnesota, we find that if these college, on the left-hand side, if these college readiness benchmarks in terms of scores are reflected, you find that most of the BIPOC communities don't show up in many of these categories, and Minnesota as a whole are not showing up in science and STEM education. So we have a lot of ground to cover, but this lack of college preparedness also then is reflected in the choice of majors, as the DEED publication brings out. And this in turn is reflected in differences in earnings and income by the various BIPOC communities. Now, historically, and I've been part of this, there have been reports and Governor Ventura appointed me to chair the Working Group on Minority Business Development that produced a report encouraging Minnesota to look at the potential of minority businesses in the state. There were other reports that have come out, but most of these recommendations have largely remained on the shelves. In the area of education too, MINEEP has brought out a number of reports over the years, and I believe about a decade ago, I was on the board of Minnesota Education Partnership, and they also have some recommendations about what could be done to close the achievement gap. So the end result of, as we look through racial disparities in Minnesota, we find there's a racial income gap, racial education gap, the racial housing gap, and the racial investment gap in terms of the size of businesses. In education, for instance, there's a 20% gap in the six-year graduation rates between Blacks and whites, 19% gap for Native Americans, 12% gap for Latinos, and 4% for Asians. And if I were to aggregate all the collective impact, the net cost to the, this is an estimate, the net cost to the BIPOC communities is around $287 billion. And the net cost to Minnesota too, because that's what Minnesota is losing in wealth creation, of $287 billion, which has implications, for instance, around taxes, which could easily be about $2 billion in state and local taxes. So how do I break down this cost of racial disparities? You can find it in income, in lifetime earnings, in business revenue, and in loss in home ownership. And so what can we do about it? I want to offer ideas and recommendations, and we call it the Minnesota Solution. Briefly, the Alana Community Brain Trust is a group of people from the African, Latino, Asian, and Native American communities that came together as COVID hit and as the civil unrest impacted our communities, to explore ways in which we could address the serious decline that was experienced by our communities beginning with COVID, and pointing to the areas of capital and capacity and collaboration, and counting on the resources and the brain power of our communities to help Minnesota achieve shared sustainable prosperity. And so the first thing that we recommend is that Minnesota looks at the Alana population, the BIPOC population, as this asset of $1.4 trillion. It's a $1.4 trillion economy, which is a huge part of the Minnesota economy, short-term and long-term. And it's very important to accept the value of a person and accept the value of what that person and communities bring to a society, because denying the value is the first building block of systemic racism and oppression. But acknowledging the value that our communities bring to Minnesota will begin the process of healing and will unleash powerful energies to build Minnesota. And so again, how do I come up with this number of $1.54 trillion? It's a combination of collective income of the community, the estimate of the business sales in Minnesota, this 500,000 workforce that are really building up the local Minnesota economy, and we could see it very vividly during the COVID crisis, and they represent a $1.4 trillion in lifetime earnings. And then the existing youth in our system that I'll talk about a little later, and the taxes that the communities pay, estimated at least $3 billion a year, and the global and cultural assets that the communities bring to Minnesota to make this a vibrant global economy. The other significant impact is that Minnesota has an aging population, and the growth in the workforce is coming from the Alana communities, one of the major contributors of the growth in the workforce, and they are going to be the future of Minnesota, not only as workforce, but potential taxpayers, and they are playing an important role, as we will see, even in higher education. And all across Minnesota, whether we look at Northeast Minnesota or Central Minnesota, we see both the workforce diversity as well as the challenges that these communities face in terms of unemployment. But they are playing such an integral part in many counties across Minnesota, including Southwest Minnesota and the metro area too. So the point that I also want to make today is that this $1.4 trillion of economic assets require political representation. And if you look at Minnesota legislative districts, there are 125 legislative districts which each represent at least 100 million in these Alana economic interests. And this comprises about 85% of the Senate and 55% of the House. And for a complete list of these districts by assets, I have links here that would show across Minnesota. And the point that I'm making is that in the two redistricting debates that happened, as well as the judicial panels that were set up to draw the districts, we presented testimony to the judicial panel about the need for political representation of these economic interests. And so I bring to you these 125 districts with over $100 million in Alana economic interests. as well as now the youth in these districts, and encourage the representation of these interests as we build Minnesota in the future. It was enlightening to hear the framework in which Speaker Hortman and Chair Moran looked at inclusion, racial inclusion strategy in the legislature as butter in the batter. And as a kid, I used to help my aunt and my mother make Christmas cakes, and I would be stirring that butter in the batter, and I know what the power of what that butter can do to the batter and how it can make a cake that everyone can enjoy. And one of the big points that I want to make today is that as we focus on our BIPOC communities, we are going to benefit, we're going to help them build wealth, build their talents. But as they build wealth and build talents, they're going to build up the whole of Minnesota as Minnesota grows. So the frame of this African-American frame, saying lift as we climb, is very pertinent to our strategies as we deal, as we invest in the BIPOC communities. Higher education now is at a pivot point, and as I make this presentation, I also want to acknowledge that I am from a higher education institution, and like other higher education institutions, we have students that benefit from the state grant program that the state has so well placed in the hands of Minnesota students. And we celebrate and thank Minnesota for that great investment in our youth. So when we look at higher education today, we see that there are certain pivot points that we need to keep in mind as we talk through what should be done about our BIPOC students. First of all, that investment in our BIPOC community is not a zero-sum game. That means there are no winners and losers as such, but strategies aimed at addressing historical injustice and their impact on BIPOC students can benefit all Minnesotans. And then we've got to remember that the demographic composition of our youth and our students are changing in Minnesota, and we have more older students joining the educational, taking advantage of educational opportunities, especially online versions of education. We're also finding that the digital transformation of higher education is causing a lot of disruption, pronounced during COVID, but coming along over the past few years. But proper investment can bring a competitive advantage to our students, because they would put them into a sector of the economy that's growing and has potential for long-term economic gain. There's also a demographic shift in population that makes the presence of BIPOC students in our universities of critical importance. And without this growing number of students in our institutions of higher education, many of their economic identity or economic presence would be at stake. And we also need to think about connecting students not only to careers, because that is ultimate well-paying, rewarding careers, but we also have to continue to integrate the importance of a liberal arts education to help us and help the youth and help our students achieve higher level of thinking in the development of our talent. And our goalposts that we set up for our students tend to be very low. So even though that Minnesota has above average outcomes for graduates and BIPOC students at the four-year level and the six-year graduation rates, the absolute numbers are relatively low, and we need to increase that and move the bar up considerably. And finally, it's not the BIPOC student fault for poor academic performance. We have to understand the impact of unjust systems and also how they impact the student's academic journey, both personal and institutional. So having said this, there are seven steps that could be important for BIPOC student success. And I'm going to go through some of them. The first thing is to look at our BIPOC youth in our school and our students in the university as an asset, a $1.5 trillion asset if all of them achieve at least a bachelor's degree as part of their journey. And if they have anything less than that, Minnesota is going to lose. It will not be 1.5 trillion. It will be considerably less. And if they go beyond it, that amount is going to grow. So we are all stewards of this very important asset. And as a point of comparison, $1.5 trillion is bigger than the GDP of Mexico. So that is the size, the immense opportunity of the asset that we have before us. The cost of not doing anything about it is what our present workforce faces. So if you look at the educational outcomes of our present workforce compared to what the rest of Minnesota has, there is an estimated loss of $174 billion in income that our BIPOC communities are experiencing. And that also is a huge amount. And so what are some of the places? So looking at our students as assets and then addressing some of these core pillars for student success and student learning. First is around affordability. Affordability goes beyond low-cost tuition or free tuition or subsidies or grants. It includes things like emergency grants and emergency assistance. It includes the easy transfer of credits so a student does not have to pay for it again. It acknowledges the fact that a student cost of tuition is just one component of their cost of living, and many of them work multiple jobs just to pay their bills, and sometimes they even are supporting their families. So we've got to look at affordability in a totality and how we can address that, and the importance of things like emergency grants is so important. I remember a colleague sharing a story that a young student in the class was not so actively engaged, and one day she found the student standing close up to the board and copying down notes, and on talking to the student found that the student's eyeglasses had broken and did not have money for to fix it. And fortunately, we had an emergency grant program that helped the student get a pair of glasses. So then we have to also look at the academic and career support services available to a student. So if you look at the earlier slide that I shared about the ACT scores and college preparedness of our student, and if you look at graduation rates by ACT scores, you'll find that some of the lowest graduation rates are tied to this academic preparedness of the student. And so when we bring the student and we want to have them succeed, we have to make sure that there is an academic and career and other kinds of support services available. Whenever a student would walk into my office as a faculty advisor, I would make sure that they would walk out from the first time they walk in, that time when they leave out, they have a foyer, they have a plan for graduation. And every time I would meet them, I would look at the plan and say, okay, here's what we need to adjust, or here's what we need to do. But the student benefited from the fact that they had a clear pathway to graduation. They also need a financial plan for graduation. How are they going to pay the bills? Because very often they get tripped up at the tail end of their graduation, where suddenly these bills show up and they're unable to finish their course of study. We also need to help them with internships and placement and resources, especially as you've heard as in testimony before you of the strong mental health challenges and the lack of resources available to our youth. And lately, we are finding also an increase in the use of food shelves. Then we need to make sure that our learning environment is culturally intelligent, that our students can see themselves in the curriculum, they can see themselves in the teachers, they can see themselves in the administration so that they know that the system works for them, because it took, for many of them, it took them a big deal to get into and to reach that academic portal or environment that they are part of. We also have to make sure that we have addressed the power structures that engage in a campus at various level, at the level of curriculum, at the level of faculty, at the level of staff, and how these power structures can also integrate the BIPOC communities at every level, because that is also going to be a very critical part of success. Finally, we have to have a very focused outcome, attention on outcomes, and to make sure that we disaggregate the data, and we know that one size doesn't fit all. So we have to intentionally focus on outcomes, and as a leader of an institution, in every aspect of an institution, people have to always be asking the question, how are we doing? What improvement have we been seeing in graduation rates and retention rates, in student success? What can we learn? What can we do better? And this focused attention is going to yield a lot of success. I found this data very interesting about the disaggregation of students, say, for instance, getting the state grant program. And very often we don't find that the students needing the resources the most getting it. But here this data shows that American Indian and Black or African Americans students, over 60% of them have actually received a state grant, which is an important part because these communities are facing some of the biggest challenges. But keep in mind that financial, there is a bigger challenge to affordability and success, as I mentioned earlier. If we also look at disaggregated data, and I believe the Coalition of Asian American Leaders are maybe presenting today too, but this is a data from their latest report to show that if you break down success rates, you'll find within the Asian community, for instance, the Burmese community have about 80% less than high school diploma. So we need to understand that when we engage with programs that target different communities, that these communities are connected to these resources because that's the only way that they can be successful. And then to understand that the relative success for other communities such as Asian Indians is because they're coming from a different historical and experience and immigration status and journey than other communities. And so their success is different from the success and challenges faced by other groups. And so finally, I want to end by saying that this is the Higher Ed Committee, and in higher ed institutions, we help to bring our students to the higher level where we can look at the big picture and look at the big analysis and look at new ways of thinking. And so in this committee, I want to offer a way to look at what we have today, the constraint of a balanced budget. But we are also in the midst of one of the worst pandemics in our history that is reshaping our economy totally, that what is going to emerge is going to be different from what we had before. And our BIPOC students and communities have been hit hardest by virtue of the fact that of the industries that they are being in, as well as because of the conditions of the racist environments that they have faced, the barriers that they have faced in the past. And so it might be worthy to look at a five-year balanced budget cycle. That means you balance the budget over a period of 5 years, and this way you can invest more right now when there is a critical momentum to build something new and develop sectors that could lead our economy in the future, and invest in these well-building infrastructures. Because 50 years from now, people are going to look back and say, okay, what did we do? What did our fathers or grandfathers or uncles or aunts, when they had the leadership position, what did they do to prepare us for what's coming in the future? So I want to thank you for this opportunity to present here, and want to end up with a short story I want to share with you. We've been part of a group of young people from 100, over 100 youth from high school youth from 30 cities and 60 school districts. And we had a group of team leaders and college leaders that helped mentor them. And these college students were from all the different campuses. And one of these young person sent me a note the other day about she lives in rural Minnesota, and she said, I didn't have a very big vision for the future, and our counselors tend to tell us that here's what you do next: get an AA degree at a community college, and then go and get a 4-year degree. And thinking about applying to the likes of Harvard never crossed my mind, but I did apply, and I did engage someone locally from a Harvard graduate. Locally reached out to me and was excited with my vision and encouraged me to apply. And now I've applied and I'm waiting to hear back. Now, that is such a very powerful story of how we can help unleash the potential of people, because the vision that they have, any youth anywhere should have the vision that they could accomplish anything, and we can open the doors for them to achieve that. Because a lot of them want to do things. And another young person from Central Lakes who influenced my way of thinking about how, for instance, we need to pay attention to foster kids and how they get lost in the system, and we need to do something about it. So it's been an honor to present these ideas to you, and I'm happy to explore questions and comments as we move forward. So thank you very much.
Okay, so I want to repeat that. Dr. Corey, thank you for your presentation today and personal and professional investments you have made into our community and state to making us stronger. I wanted to, we have two questions on deck, I see, and actually three. Representative Mason, and then we have Representative Albright on deck. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a couple of comments. Obviously, balancing the budget over 4 years is a creative proposal, so I appreciate that very, very much. And I think one of the things about serving in the legislature is knowing how many students or children are out there that really need a lot of help. And I appreciate, again, I appreciate the thought that he has put into this. So thank you.
Representative Albright. And then just want to say we have Representative Thompson on deck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Corey, thank you for the presentation today. I do want to refer you back to your presentation deck. To a couple of statements that were made in your one slide. And first is that our goalposts for student outcomes are low. And I achievement is something that is both inspirational and aspirational, coming from both the teaching aspect, but as also, you know, the student themselves. So I'm wondering, could you just elaborate on that? And Madam Chair, I have a couple more follow-ups after that.
Dr. Corey.
Chair Bernardi and Representative Albright, thank you for the question. We tend to measure ourselves relatively. So if we say a 4-year graduation rate, I don't have the exact number in front of me, say is 36%. That 36% is low. And if a 6-year graduation rate, say, is 60%, it also means 2 extra years of cost that a student has to imply. So why don't we focus on making sure that in the 4 years, we move that bar up considerably so that all students can have the opportunity to graduate on time. And I really appreciate your comment about inspiration and aspiration. When I teach my macroeconomics class or my economics class, you know, it's tough. And somewhere around the mid-semester, I would find that a student, I see a number of students with C's and D's. And so I would tell them, hey, listen, my final is comprehensive. You really have to think and you really have to integrate all the materials to do my final. But if you give me an A on my final, I'll think about your grade. And I would always be inspired because the kind of quality A class answers I would get from these students. So I realized that sometimes limits exist in your mind, and with the right set of circumstances and incentives and inspiration, you can improve your conditions. I hope that answers your question.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Corey, thank you for the answer. I do appreciate the answer and how you articulated it. But I'm struck with a bit of a conflict by my follow-on question, because in the next bullet point underneath the one that I just noted, and this is not intended to be an accusation, but it says that it is not the BIPOC students' fault for poor academic outcomes. We have to understand the impact of unjust systems and also allow how they impact BIPOC students' academic journey, both personal and institutional. Getting back to your response and as well as my question, how do we assess the responsibility of the student to aspire for a higher expected outcome if we also in the same breath say it's not really your fault if you don't achieve those aspirational heights?
Dr. Corey.
Chair Moradi and Representative Albright, I appreciate the question and the insight. And I think as a professor, and one of the things that my institution kind of encouraged us to think about ourselves, our job is not, we are there not as professor as a job. We are there with a sense of purpose, a calling, that we have to be on the lookout to serve the student, because we have been given, we are stewards of these, what I mentioned, $1.4 trillion and $5.0 trillion asset statewide. So how do we meet the student where they are, understand where they're coming from, understanding the challenges that some of the students have, maybe first generation students, that have come to a classroom, and how could we make and create conditions that help them succeed? So it's a two-way engagement. And then the deeper question that you're asking about is a question that we debate a lot about individual versus systems and the cause and the effect. And what I want to encourage people to do is to go beyond that, to understand that we have concrete evidence of systems of racism that have had deep impacts on people, and many of them from my research have impacts inside the mother's womb, and so there are we have to work with the young people that we have, help them, inspire them, empower them. Actually, empowerment is the word, to shape their own destinies. And there are stories around the world of how people have done that to communities, that now they become the shapers of their own destiny. So it's going to be a very engaged environment that could lift everybody up.
Okay, we have two more members on deck, and we have about six members left. Representative Albright, did you have any other questions that you would like to ask and add you onto the list again?
No, Madam Chair, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Thompson, and we have Representative Neuer on deck. Representative Thompson.
Yes, thank you so much, Chair. Professor Corey, you said something that struck me when you said administrators, people, teachers, professors, how hard is it? What's the challenge? It seems like it almost stops at the Human Resource Department. What's the challenge? And like it's almost like that in every university where we don't have representation that looks like us, that actually have any knowledge of our culture or you know, it does make a difference when you have people that respond. So in your presentation, thank you again, Professor. This is not the first time that I've been in a room with you. There's a couple of gems in our community, and you're definitely one of them, and I want to say thank you for that also. But just what is the challenge in trying to get, you know, culturally competent, specific, you know, people that look like us, that understand us as BIPOC people? So, I just want to know, can you pinpoint that?
Dr. Corey.
Chair Bernardi and Representative Thompson, thank you for your kind words and thank you for your question. Ultimately, I think if we always put the student at the center of what we are doing, very often we develop curriculum or we develop programs or we develop things and they are for the adults, the professor, the institution's benefit. The student is not the center. And this student that is in my class, in your class, wants to learn in an environment that's free, that they can express themselves. They don't want to feel let down like a young high school student told me. It's those little things that I get the message that I'm not appreciated. And those little things build up, and soon I kind of withdraw instead. We don't need that noise in education. We need it to be clear. And we need to understand, for instance, that if someone is not speaking up, like in certain cultures, like in the Asian community, you have to be invited to speak because that's your culture. You don't button into a conversation and say things. And so someone has to understand that's the way you've got to relate to communities and departments like financial aid or registry or food services. The people on the front line that engage with these students have to be trained how to speak. The most simplest thing is being welcoming and friendly to someone who walks to the door and guide them, because you can't just throw a bunch of paper to them and say, fill it up. We've got to walk them through what's needed. As I said, when a student walked in my office, I would sit down with that student and do a four-year plan. We need to do things like that, and we need to try to understand and bring examples from their lives and from their communities so they can see the importance. I'm an economist, and I never got calculus in my school days till I was at the University of Notre Dame, and I saw how calculus showed this economic argument. And I said, oh, is that it? So that intuitive understanding I never received. And we need to help students get those kind of understanding that will take them to the next path.
No
Representative, okay, thank you. Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Corey, for your dedication and vision on justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. You have spoken to us clearly in different ways for us to understand the pathways that we have to face. As you have had, the University of Minnesota has seen an increase for students of color. So it's a place that we need to look into how we can support the universities. In fact, the university that is right next door to me, Augsburg University, they have seen for the last 10 years the inverse. You know, the trend has been changing. Almost 60% of students who go to Augsburg University are students who are BIPOC. Compared to 10 years, it was the opposite of what they're seeing. So institutions are working hard to make sure that they adapt to the changing demographic as we see it, because it's critical for our economy, as you have already talked about, and also for students to understand their place to ensure that they can take advantage of the learning and the tools that they gain to help us to thrive in our economy. I won't go to that question, but I had a different question in regards to that. As a state, we usually don't focus on the economy as a whole when it comes to micro entrepreneurs or micro enterprise and helping people learned through the colleges and also in the communities, the BIPAC, to support the small businesses that you indicated. How can we help link the higher education institutions with the support for the economy to help micro enterprise, the incubators that you just talked about?
Dr. Corey.
Chair Bernardi and Representative Noor, thank you for your words, kind words, and also for your question. I remember one day I was walking through Fairview and I saw this building and I looked at, there was a boxing gym in there. So I walked in there and I discovered it was one of my former students, Dalton, who has this Element Box. What a beautiful, I was so impressed by this facility that it since then has grown and has become really good. But I thought to myself, when he was sitting in my class, did I ever think of the potential that he would be as an entrepreneur, right? And there he is, see how successful he was. To your question about how we could get engaged, recently we invited, Little Africa is by our university, so one of our chair of our business department reached out to the businesses and say, can our students help you think about either how you might do a website or how you might do some consulting on some element of your businesses? And three of these businesses came forward and the students shared some input about how they could do it. Now, it was a win-win for both. The students got that experience of actually working with a small business, and the businesses got insights from a demographic that could be important for their own customer base and how to reach out to them. And so you're right, we could work on it. As I mentioned to you, President Ron Thomas of Dakota County, he was working on this concept of how can community colleges be a source of these entrepreneurial education and working with local businesses in the area.
Representative Noor, did you have a follow-up?
I appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair, and also to Dr. Bruce. Thank you so much, Dr. Corey.
Okay, members, we are going to thank you, Dr. Corey, for your presentation today, and we wish you the best in your work and working with students. Thank you so much. The next on our agenda today, we have a presentation from the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership on their 2021 higher education recommendations. Joining us, we have the co-chairs of the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership, College Race Equity Efficacy Advisory Council, Megan Rosowski and Sally Hollis. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Rosowski, would you please proceed?
Great. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Megan Rosowski, and I'm the Director of Research at the Minnesota Private College Council. I am here today on behalf of the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership. And as the chair said, I co-chair the College Race Equity Advocacy Advisory Council, the CREAC for short. My co-chair, Dr. Sandy Paulus, is here today, and Leiatawa, Dr. John Peterson, who leads this work for Manip, regrets he can't be here today as he is working on another of Manip's key initiatives, supporting emerging multilingual learners. We are very saddened by the tragedy in Buffalo today, and our hearts go out to all those who are affected. Manip's mission is to transform systems, structures, and public narratives to advance race equity and excellence in education. Five values center this work: equity, justice, history, relationships, and self-actualization. Manip believes in fixing systems and structures, not students of color and Indigenous students. Students do not need to be fixed. What does race equity in higher education look like? People of color and Indigenous students, families, and teachers are provided with the learning assistance specific to their needs and full access to learning opportunities that build on their talents and cultural assets. Those who are most impacted by inequities have the space to build power and lead through collective action. People of color and Indigenous students and families provide input into decisions that affect their educational and life opportunities. Race equity is raising the achievement of all students while eliminating the racial predictability and disproportionality of which students occupy the highest and lowest achievement levels. Race equity is actualized fairness and justice. The House Select Committee on Racial Justice report, which was released in December, highlights the disparities in educational attainment by race and ethnicity in Minnesota. Minnesota's Educational Attainment Goal 2025 sets a goal of achieving race equity in higher education outcomes. The policy recommendations we are sharing today will help the state achieve the goal of 70% of Minnesotans in each racial and ethnic group achieving a post-secondary certificate or degree. In 2020, MNEEP released the policy brief, Reducing Racial Disparities in Higher Education. This research was funded by the Joyce Foundation and co-authored by Dr. Michael Duenas and Dr. Krista Soria. This research was guided by a research collaborative table that included members from the University of Minnesota, Minnesota State, private nonprofit colleges, and community members. The research identified systemic limitations to the state financial aid system. Current financial aid policies do not meet the needs of POSSE students, and these policies serve as barriers to college access and completion for our POSSE students. The Joyce Foundation provided a second round of funding for MNEEP to assemble the CREAC, a statewide multiracial advocacy group to plan, promote, and direct a new policy agenda that centers race equity in higher education. CREAC membership includes community members, system and institutional partners, and nonprofits. CREAC has met with leaders from the University of Minnesota, Minnesota State, private colleges, and the Office of Higher Education to discuss how we can all work together to center race equity in higher education in Minnesota. CREAC will hold a statewide convening of higher education leaders in June. Madam Chair, with your permission, I would like to turn the testimony over to Dr. Sandy Pullis to present CREAC's policy recommendations.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee, Ms. Pullis. You may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Sandy Pullis, and I work at CERB Minnesota as the Vice President of Equity and Inclusion. I first just want to acknowledge the tragic events that happened in Buffalo today and send my thoughts and prayers to that community. Findings from the policy brief that Megan mentioned, as well as input from the CREAC, resulted in what we're calling the Minnesota Promise, which aims to increase access and degree completion for students of color and American Indian and Indigenous students in two ways. First, by modernizing student supports like the Minnesota State Grant and financial aid supports. And second, by providing POSSE students or BIPOC students with more holistic wraparound supports. Before I get into that, I want to just talk a little bit about why we're focusing on the Minnesota State Grant. Our research brief showed that the way that the Minnesota State Grant currently structured does not meet the needs or support POSSE students. But what we do know is that POSSE students receiving need-based grants, such as the Minnesota State Grant, have higher retention and completion rates and reduced borrowing, resulting in narrowing educational attainment gaps, which we know is a commitment that we have here in Minnesota, given our 2025 attainment goal. Some quick facts to highlight is that 56% of POSSE students receive state grants, according to the MMB, there was a $4.10 return for every dollar spent on the Minnesota State Grant. The first area of focus is really on modernizing financial aid to improve college access and degree completion for POSSE students. The following recommendations help in that area, and the first four are really tied directly to the Minnesota State Grant. The first is on reducing the student responsibility for the Minnesota State Grant. Second, increase the calculation for the living and miscellaneous expenses. Third, extending the credit threshold beyond the 120 credits. And fourth, ensuring that the developmental education courses do not count against state grant. Now, I do want to point out that both policy recommendations 2 and 4 are already baked into the governor's proposed budget that recently came out. The fifth area is providing support so that 85% of students who identify as POSSE or BIPOC and from low-income high schools have a chance to complete the FAFSA. As we know, that's the first step in towards college attainment. And then the last area is expanding the Minnesota Work Study Program. The second area focuses on providing POSSE BIPOC students with holistic wraparound supports needed to complete a college degree. So we have a couple of recommendations in this area. First, we're recommending a full analysis of developmental educational offerings and outcomes and require that multiple measures for course placement are used, as we know that the AccuPlacer often over-identifies and places POSSE BIPOC students into developmental education courses. Second, from these analyses, we're recommending phasing out traditional developmental education courses and reinvest in holistic student supports. Third, we're requesting finally disaggregated reporting on race, specifically for transfer students who stop out, to then improve transfer policies and shorten time to degree. And lastly, we're asking for additional funding for all faculty and staff in higher education so they have more access to training on culturally responsive teaching, racial equity, and anti-racist teaching practices. And with that, I thank you, committee and Madam Chair, and I hand it back to you.
Thank you, Dr. Polis. And I'm sorry, I didn't know about your credentials. And so I want to make sure I acknowledge that you are a doctor. Thank you for your presentation. And members, we are going to move on to our next presentation and then have questions after we hear from Andrew Morris, the Public Affairs and Legislative Liaison at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And he is going to talk about this report. And we welcome to our committee, Mr. Morris. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andy Morris, and I serve as the Public Affairs and Legislative Liaison at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today to the long-standing needs of the Asian Pacific Minnesotan community regarding higher education. To provide some background on our communities, the Asian Pacific Minnesotan community is descended from more than 40 nationalities and is arguably the most diverse community in the state. To provide a clear picture of the challenges facing Asian Pacific Minnesotans as they relate to higher education, we need to address the model minority myth. This term, originally coined to describe earlier immigrant communities who achieved great success, such as the Japanese and Chinese, has become the lens through which many Americans view Asian American communities and justify public policy decisions. Nationally, the model minority conversation has been driven by the extraordinary successes of the Japanese and Chinese American, Korean Americans, and Asian Indian communities. These groups, highly educated, native-born, financially successful, and with personal, family, and business wealth, and a high percentage of home ownership, are the backbone of the model minority myth. Their success, however, skews the averages up. Minnesota's Asia-Pacific stories are different when taken as a whole. Minnesotans of Hmong, Vietnamese, Lao, Cambodian, Bhutanese, and Karen heritage make Minnesota's Asian-Pacific community different from those in any other state. Ours is a majority refugee-experienced community. These refugee-experienced communities do not have generations of family wealth and stability, a tradition of higher education, home ownership, and established support networks. Many are experiencing formal education for the first time with its structural and institutional barriers and challenges. Their realities include facts such as that 47% of Cambodian Minnesotans identify as limited English proficient. 72% of Vietnamese Minnesotans hold less than a bachelor's degree. 27% of Hmong Minnesotan families with children live in poverty. And only 18% of the Burmese, Karen, own their own home. Our policies must reflect these realities in order for us to support students from our diverse communities more effectively. As we consider these challenges, however, we must examine how existing programs and support systems have not always reached those they were intended to benefit. This can be a particularly acute challenge in our refugee-experienced communities, especially when populations may have limited English proficiency or may even lack literacy in their own native language, let alone in English. These challenges have most recently been exacerbated by a lack of access to technology, such as laptops and broadband internet, which have become essential components in the pursuit of education. It is with this in mind that we ask that policies and their delivery systems be designed while keeping in mind the people they are intended to support. Today, I would like to share with you what our council has heard directly from community members over the years as it relates to challenges in attaining a higher education. For Asian Pacific Minnesotans, these challenges can be broadly defined as related to access, affordability, and the broader economic impact on their communities. When discussing the challenges students face in accessing higher education, we must not forget that this includes both their time as college students and their time in high school. Providing support to high schools and students to prepare them for and even inform them about college opportunities is crucial to ensuring that they have the proper access to higher education. One Chinese Minnesotan parent said, "With four children in my family and two in college, we still struggle to find support for our children to continue their secondary education. My children are having challenges with adjusting to school, and I would like to see support services available for the whole family. I would like to learn about services that are available." Of course, having a college-ready high school education and the academic ability to succeed in college does not guarantee that a degree will be earned in 2, 4, or even 6 or more years. Too many promising students are either left with no means to pursue their desired education or no alternative other than taking on a financial burden they will carry for many years. For some students, this includes taking on a debt burden without supports needed to finish their degree. One Hmong Minnesotan student told our council, "There are not many opportunities for higher education for students after high school, especially for those from low-income families. Financial aid does help, but it does not cover 100% of the needed college expenses. Many students are not going for a higher education." When we hear community members speak about their experience, we hear them talk about the economic impact that they take on from seeking a higher education as not only one that they take on themselves as students, but as one that impacts their entire communities. While the challenges and risks of higher education are often understood as those only impacting individual students, we have frequently heard from community members that higher education impacts the economic health and stability of the entire community. Now, there is no reason that this cannot be true of both the benefits as well as the challenges of a higher education, but we must always be mindful to ensure that supports properly find those they are intended to assist. In addition to the council's own testimony today, the committee has heard important testimony about critical steps it can take to meet the needs of all Minnesotans. When asked, "How can the state help you in your community?" one Vietnamese student responded, "Reach out to residents and listen to understand their stories of struggles. Create more policies that cater towards the people who are in need. Create more community events that are inclusive to everyone." This and earlier quotes I shared with you are powerful statements from our community members. They speak strongly to the need for more targeted support for Asian Pacific Minnesotans and other communities of color. More Minnesotans will reach their full educational and economic potential if we heed this advice. Our council is always available to you. We were created by the legislature in 1984 to advise you, to advocate on behalf of Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and to connect you with your own Asian Pacific Minnesotan constituents, please do not hesitate to call on us. One point that I would like to end my testimony on is this. The input I shared with you today about the challenges facing Asian Pacific Minnesotans as they relate to higher education were gathered during the course of our 2018 legislative priority survey, which informed our 2019 to 2020 biennial legislative agenda. As you have heard and are well aware by now, the challenges and obstacles facing our communities have only grown since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, making them all the more formidable to community members today. We look forward to working with you to address these critical and long-standing challenges. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for your time today and for allowing me to speak to these issues.
Thank you, Mr. Morris, Ms. Dr. Polis, and Ms. Rozowski. Now we would like to ask members if they have any questions for our testifiers today. We have Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did have one question. A few others I could ask, but one kind of stood out. First of all, just thank you to all the testifiers today. Sincerely appreciate everybody taking the time to work on this issue. I'm a Minn State graduate and thoroughly appreciated and enjoyed my experience on campus. One of the first opportunities I had to connect with my campus, though, was taking the Accuplacer. And I was wondering if maybe Dr. Sandy Bowles, I hope I pronounced your name correctly, Doctor, might be able to clarify her comment and help me understand. I was one of the kids that was identified that could benefit from taking a remedial class as the Accuplacer recognized that I was missing some necessary skills. And I took the class that I needed, got up to speed, and it really was exactly what I needed. So I'm wondering what the doctor might have been referring to and maybe have some solutions if there is an issue with the Accuplacer, what that is. And I think the comment was that the Accuplacer over-identifies some minorities or minorities in general. I might have missed the back half of your comment, doctor, but if you could maybe expand on that a little bit and help me understand where the problem might be in that system. You know, it was beneficial in my case, but, you know, maybe there are cases where it's not. Needed a little help.
Dr. Polis.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I just want to comment and say, based on our policy brief and interviewing students and reviewing research, seeing that data suggested that students, BIPOC students in particular, are over-identified, and my colleague Megan perhaps can share a little bit more data on that, and overplaced in cases where they maybe don't need to take that course. And then what we start seeing is early trends of, you know, added costs, including added costs to take the Accuplacer in some cases for sites that require that as an extra fee, or already baked into an additional registration fee that the student might have to be taking or might have to pay early on. And then it sort of, for some students, sort of reinforces that narrative for them that they're not good at math, that college is difficult. And if they have a negative experience early on in those remedial courses, it could sort of set up a trajectory for how they are viewing their college experience. And so what we're suggesting is that there are additional measures that are used. So looking at their high school performance, what are some other areas that we can look at to really get an assessment of how students are doing in math? And then also, what are some other holistic supports on campus, tutoring or other strategies that can be used in place of remedial education to support students?
Representative Heintzman, did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. you know, not necessarily a follow-up, but maybe a clarification if I could continue to get one. So I understand that there may be other factors that could play into how that assessment is taken. And maybe referring back to high school, as you suggested, could in some cases be a beneficial factor to consider. But of course, resources are extremely limited. And I'm wondering, you know, in some cases, high schools are graduating students and maybe they haven't fully prepared them in a particular subject area, and their grades may even miss that reflection. So it's hard to know if there's a mathematical solution there to actually provide input that will maybe put the AccuPlacer in a different place. But I think that the question that I would want to expand on there a little bit is there actual evidence that shows that the AccuPlacer is missing students? In my case, it identified me as needing to have some help in a subject area, and it absolutely worked. And I benefited from that. Do we have hard data to show that? Or is this something that's anecdotal? I sure appreciate some help again.
Dr. Polis.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I actually see my colleague Megan has unmuted herself, so if I could ask that she answer that question.
Okay, Ms. Rozowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, there's been some research to show that the AccuPlacer does not align well with the standards such as the MCA. So we're not aligning the high school curriculum to what's tested with the AccuPlacer. And there are currently several Minnesota State colleges, for example, that no longer use the AccuPlacer. They're using other measures to place students in courses. Another option, there's a lot of research that shows that co-requisite courses are beneficial for, as you said, getting students up to speed, but it'll have a course that's credit-bearing for college credit, while at the same time students are enrolled in some additional support so that it doesn't end up sort of as this road to nowhere with too many developmental courses. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Heinzman, are we concluding and we can go to Representative Albright, or would you like a follow-up to that?
No, Madam Chair, I think that we've done the best we could on that one. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Polis, thank you for the presentation, and to Ms. Rozowski for the presentation. One of the theses that I see, and I did last night read through the entirety of your policy brief, and while time doesn't permit me to ask all the questions, I will give maybe an overarching thought to you. It would appear from this white paper that your proposal is that a four-year education is the only way to propel an individual into a vibrant and successful career. And I won't draw you to the notes that I've made. We can probably follow up on that later, but I will draw you to one point that is made in your policy brief, and it's on page 14, where you say that POSSE students are more likely to be enrolled in two-year state colleges. In a follow-up, it says lower income is correlated with increased enrollment at state colleges and for-profit institutions. Well, that probably is a statement with truth on its prima facie. I would ask you, how many of those students are actually in their first career development phase, or how many of those students are going back for a career advancement? And rather than drive 45 minutes to the university, a four-year college, say University of Minnesota, you seem to have a fairly particular focus on them, going to Normandale or to Anoka Ramsey for additional coursework when it's maybe 10 minutes away from where they live. What would you say in response to that that proposal?
Who would like to take that one, Dr. Polis or Ms. Rozowski? I don't have a full, Ms. Rozowski.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Albright, for your question. It's hard to get longitudinal data. There's some in SLEDS that shows folks along their career continuum, but data from DEED does show that about 60% of jobs that pay family-sustaining wages in Minnesota require a bachelor's degree or higher. I personally believe that there's dignity in all work, and I think that a lot of folks are underpaid for their work. My dad's a roofer. Sometimes folks think that a bachelor's degree is the only way, and that's obviously not true. But POSSE students are disproportionately enrolled in associate degree programs, like you said. And then when we look at degree attainment, white people in Minnesota are more likely to have bachelor's degree and graduate degrees. And so I believe that, and Monique believes that POSSE students should have true choice in what type of college degree that they can attain, whether you want to be a doctor or a teacher or a lawyer, or whether you want to be a welder or a plumber or a pharmacy tech. And right now we don't really have that true choice. And so that's part of what we're talking about. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sure I have a couple of follow-ups. And Dr. Polis, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Polis, I'm intrigued by your statement that you suggested that we move from the current model to one that's more holistic. And removal of those developmental educational courses. 2 points. The first one isn't that more of an indictment on our K-12 system not preparing students of color, or for that matter, any student for a secondary education? And really the focus should be a dual track in preparing them to be prepared for a secondary college educational experience. And then also, what would you say in terms of, are you setting those students up for potential failure if your standards, as Dr. Corey suggested, we have a very substantially low bar. If we're trying to raise the bar, but yet we're setting them up with false expectations about success, can you understand the contrast and the conflict that you're creating?
Okay, Dr. Polis, and we just to let members know, we have Representative Cleburne on deck, and that's okay, so go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. Yes, there definitely is more work at the high school level too in preparing students for college, and we recognize a need right now at the secondary level, the college level, and ensuring that we are supporting students. And we also just see a benefit in terms of being able to support students through other means as well, other tutoring programs or other areas where students still can receive support and not necessarily through remedial education.
Madam Chair, I just have a quick follow-up for Dr. Polis then, and she can answer either in the yes or no. Has been
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pawlowski and I have for a number of years supported the notion and the proposal of returning the technical trade curriculum back into the high schools, so that not only does a senior in high school graduate with a diploma, but also with a skill set that is available to get a job and seek out those opportunities. Would you support that action?
Dr. Polis.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. I fully support students having access to make choices for whatever career they choose.
Okay, we have Representative Cleburne.
Madam Chair, I would like to thank all of the people who came to speak to us today. It was the first time I've really had an opportunity to hear Dr. Corey speak, and there's more I would like to hear from Dr. Corey. And then Dr. Polis, I just want to say I really appreciated the presentation that you gave today, and I didn't know much about your organization. So when I pulled up the Who We Are piece, the credentials are quite impressive. So thank you very much for the quality of work and research and the thought that goes into these reports that you've put together and presented to us today. When I think about a very simple example of the hurdles that our students face, you know, things like access to capital and how do students when the backstop that they need, so when they have those hiccups in finance, whether their hours got cut that week or whether there is a surprise fee on their bill that they weren't expecting. And it's those, sometimes it's those micro costs that cause students to step back, right? And not be able to complete their education. And those are things, as I've been looking more and more into the way student loans are granted, the interest rates that are charged, the fees that are charged, the interest that accrues, and all of those pieces that prevent students from being able to complete those last 2 years of a degree. I'm wondering, is there any research going on in that area as well? This whole piece about students seeing their loans after the associate's degree and saying, I can't afford to go on to a four-year degree. I just like to know if there's any research like that going on as it affects BIPOC students. I should clarify that.
Madam Chair, I think you're muted.
Thank you.
Oh, okay, thank you. So did you want to answer that question, Dr. Paulus, or would that be Ms. Rozowski?
I can start, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Cleveland. Yes, so I think, you know, that part of our recommendations, the last slide that I presented talked a little bit about looking at disaggregated data for BIPOC students who transfer and stop out to really have an understanding of what are some of those barriers, so that way we can provide some recommendations and a deeper understanding for how to support students who stop out.
My concern,
Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My concern is that, you know, when we give birth to our children, we look at them and we think, oh, what is all of the wonder that they can be? And then we have all of these different hurdles that keep us from being successful in lives, zig and zag. But I would just like to say, making sure that we have this high quality data to look at and to understand those hurdles more fully is very helpful to us. And I just want to say thank you for being here today and sharing your expertise with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, we don't have any more questions. I want to let you know that tomorrow the University of Minnesota will be coming here to go through their budget request, and want to again extend our thoughts and prayers to the people in the Buffalo community, those families affected, and Representative O'Neill in this tragedy that happened today. Members, we will see you tomorrow. Thank you. And thank you, Dr. Paulus and Mr. Morris and Ms. Rozowski. Thank you for being here today. The meeting is adjourned.